Thank you all for coming out tonight, and thank you, Dr. Wolf, for that very kind introduction. And thank you also to Mrs. Eber for doing all the hard work in setting up this event tonight. And thank you, those of you who are Cowboys fans and might rather perhaps be watching something else tonight. Sorry. It's one of the things we don't appreciate in the Northeast. Okay, so my talk tonight is entitled Don't Forget to Remember, the Importance of Cultural Memory. And my subject tonight is cultural memory. And I'm going to be exploring how late 17th century English men and women remembered the events of their country's Civil War, and how their memories of those wars shaped the English Restoration that followed. I want to begin, though, by reading a passage to you from one of my favorite books on English history, probably not one of the most academic books, though, and that is 1066 and All That. A memorable history of England comprising all the parts you can remember. So, in their preface to the book, the authors write, quote, "The object of this history is to console the reader. No other history does this. History is not what you thought. It is what you can remember. All other history defeats itself. This is the only memorable history of England, because all the history that you can remember is in this book, which is the result of years of research in golf clubs, gun rooms, green rooms, etc." So, how we remember history, or perhaps more appropriately, how we misremember or forget history, is what I want to focus on in my talk tonight. Because to a great extent, history, for those of us outside of the academy, for those of us out in the real world, is what we remember. Not what we learn in the classroom. So, with the monarchy, the English monarchy, I should say, being restored in 1660, the king and his ministers sought to erase much of the history of the past 20 years. And as much as possible, they sought to restore the kingdom to the way it had been in the early decades of the 17th century. And so tonight, I'll examine how they attempted to do this, and then I'll assess how successful they were in trying to achieve their goals. Lastly, I'll offer up a few thoughts on how all of this relates to the study of history at Cambridge. First, though, since, as Dr. Wolf said, the subject is a little obscure, requires a little bit more background. And I need to explain just what it is that the king was so eager to forget in the 1660s. And what he and many of his ministers very much would have liked to forget were the history of the civil wars and the interregnum. So the civil wars began in 1642 as a conflict between the King Charles I and his parliament. There are historians who have devoted their entire careers to this, and quite frankly, none of us have time for that. So I'll try and give you the quick and dirty executive summary that I give to my 10th grade students. So the Civil War essentially had three causes. The first of those being King Charles needed money. So the first cause is a financial crisis. The only way, though, that Charles could get that money was from new taxes, and the only way that he could create new taxes was with Parliament's consent. And so the second cause of the Civil Wars was Parliament itself. Parliament, as Charles well knew, was not just going to give him the money that he wanted. Parliament never gave any kings money in the early modern period without getting something in return. And Charles was well aware of this. The other problem with Parliament was that, unlike our Congress, which is always in session, the English Parliament in the 17th century is only in session when the king calls it into session. And up until Charles's financial crisis, Parliament hadn't met for 11 straight years, which was far too long. And when they did finally meet, they were not happy about it, and they made sure that Charles knew that. The third and the final cause of the Civil Wars was religion. England had been a Protestant country. Charles was trying to make changes to the Church of England, and changes that many of his subjects thought looked decidedly Catholic. And for his Protestant subjects, this was unacceptable. even more unacceptable for the Puritans, who had thought the church was far too Catholic to begin with. So when the war broke out, on the one side we have King Charles and his supporters, the Cavaliers, and on the other side we have Parliament and their supporters, the Roundheads. And as 1066 and all that famously put it, the Cavaliers were, quote, wrong but romantic, the Roundheads right but repulsive. So in other words, Parliament, the Roundheads did emerge the victor, but they weren't much fun. So Parliament not only won the war, but they captured the king. They tried the king for treason. They sentenced him to death and they beheaded him. And with the king's execution in 1649, this marks the start of the period that we call the interregnum. And the interregnum is a period of 11 years when England has no king. So literally Latin, between kings. During the interregnum, England would be governed at times by Puritan divines, at times by Cromwells, and ultimately by army generals. None of these governments, with the exception of Oliver Cromwell's personal rule, were particularly successful, stable, or effective. And by the last years of the 1650s, there was increasing support for a restoration of the monarchy. Although Charles I had been executed, his children had gone into exile and had been living in France. And now the army generals, with the last remnants of Parliament, took it upon themselves to invite Charles's oldest son, conveniently also named Charles, to return to England and for the monarchy to be restored. And so on May 29th, 1660, Charles II, the son of Charles I, returns to English soil and the monarchy is restored. And this is the period that we call the Restoration. So the immediate problem facing the new king was how to reconcile the restored monarchy with the political upheavals of the last 20 years. Some of the same men who had once taken arms against Charles's father and had served in the governments of the interregnum now invited him to return as their king. So the solution which Charles and his chancellor, the Earl of Clarendon, Henry Hyde, came up with was to forget as much of the unpleasantness of the last 20 years, as much of the unpleasantness as the Civil War and the interregnum as possible. Now, neither man was so naive as to believe that they could simply sweep everything under the rug. They knew that there were some things that could not be forgotten and indeed should not be forgotten, foremost among them the fact that Charles I was executed. During Clarendon's tenure as Lord Chancellor, he and the King, he and Charles II, worked together to cast the Restoration both as a continuation of the English monarchy and at the same time the start of something new. And in doing so, they demanded that their subjects adopt a kind of selective amnesia, selectively forgetting certain parts of the past, but at the same time remembering monarchy. Even before Charles returned to England, he and Clarendon had already begun to plan for the restoration, for their new regime. If the English people were to welcome Charles back with open arms, he had to reassure them that all would be forgiven, and that he would not hold the entire kingdom responsible for the sins of a few. To this end, Charles issued the Declaration of Breda in April of 1660, about 2 months before he returned to England. Recognizing that the kingdom was still very much divided, Charles wrote, quote, "If the general distraction and confusion which is spread over the whole kingdom doth not awaken all men to a desire and longing that those wounds which so many years have been kept bleeding may be bound up, then all that we can say will be to no purpose." Charles, in the declaration, cast himself as the royal physician who would heal his kingdom's wounds. He promised that his return would be, quote, "with as little blood and damage to our people as possible." Rather than punish those who took arms against his late father, Charles promised that they would be pardoned. On religion, the other divisive issue which had torn his kingdom apart, Charles II promised to end factional strife. Charles's declaration offered up a vision of the future in which all divisions would be healed, and he promised that all of his subjects should have, quote, "liberty of tender consciences." that in other words, all Christians should be free to practice their faith, whether Catholic or Protestant, Anglican or Puritan. And so Charles offered up a new age, one in which England would receive a new start, but at the same time under an old king. And from the very beginning, Charles always insists that he's king from the moment his father is executed. But even though he can't actually do anything as king until the 1660s, he says that his reign begins when his father is executed. And so the Declaration of Breda is very much an outline of Charles's vision for the Restoration. However, publicly promising these things in the Declaration was one thing, but actually putting them into effect was another. And as soon as Parliament officially recognized Charles as the king, he and Clarendon put forward legislation to begin the process. And the centerpiece of Charles's legislative campaign to bring about this new era was called the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion. So the first part of the act, the indemnity, or we would say pardon, was so important to Charles that while he's on the ship over from the continent, while he's on his way back to England, Charles forwards the text of the bill to Parliament so they can get a start on passing this. And Charles insists that they make this their top legislative priority, that after they've confirmed him as king, this has to be the number one task on their legislative agenda. Unfortunately for Charles, while the pardon that he promised had been popular with many of those who had fought for Parliament in the Civil Wars, it met with a lot of resistance from former Cavaliers. Many of the Cavaliers did not share Charles's willingness to forgive and to forget. After Parliament had received the text of the bill, the Cavaliers took it upon themselves to compile a definitive list of everyone who had committed some kind of unforgivable sin and should not be subject to the pardon. A definitive list of everyone who should be excluded. Charles himself was very annoyed that Parliament decided to do this, and he quickly grew tired with the pettiness and narrow-mindedness of people who had been supporters of his father, and he urged them to speed the bill along. Charles told Parliament, quote, "We must not think that God Almighty hath wrought the miracle to that degree, that a nation so miserably divided for so many years is so soon entirely united. The hearts of the people have been filled with a terrible apprehension of insecurity. Nothing could establish the security of the king and people but a full provision that the returning to the reverence and obedience should not turn to the ruin of any who are willing and fit to pay subjection to it." So in other words, Charles recognized that the kingdom remained divided, that just because Parliament says he's the king again doesn't mean that the country is going to be at peace and stable. And Charles hoped that by offering the pardon, people who had once been rebels might now repent of their previous actions and be loyal to him and be good subjects once more. And the sooner the bill was passed, the sooner Charles believed that his kingdom would be stable, would be peaceful again. So Parliament had begun debating the bill in May of 1660, and much to Charles's dismay, it took them until August to finally pass it. Ultimately, the pardon contained in the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion was, despite lengthy debate, quite generous. All treasonous offenses that had been committed before the 1st of January, 1637, a full 5 years before the Civil War started, all such offenses were to be pardoned. And at the end, in the final version of the bill, Parliament only excluded about 50 specific people from the benefit of the pardon. And to be quite frank, some of those people were already dead, like Oliver Cromwell, so it didn't really matter if Cromwell was pardoned or not. The second and more daring part of the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion was the Oblivion. And for the Oblivion, all discussions of the upheavals of the past 20 years were to be severely curtailed. In particular, the goal of this being so that, quote, "all names and terms of distinction may likewise be put into oblivion. If any person within the space of the next 3 years ensuing shall presume maliciously to call or to allege of or object against any other person, or use any name or names or other words of reproach tending to revive the memory of the late differences or the occasions thereof, then the guilty party should make substantial monetary compensation to the person offended. So in other words, Charles is saying for the next 3 years, we're just not gonna talk about this. We're not gonna call names. We're not gonna talk about people being roundheads anymore. We're gonna act as if that didn't happen. And if someone does get called a roundhead, a Puritan, or some other derisive or perceived to be derisive name in that context, then they have the right to take civil action to get monetary compensation for that. So, although in some ways the oblivion is much more radical than the pardon, the oblivion actually attracts almost no debate in the House of Commons. This is relatively uncontroversial with them. They make a huge fuss over who should be excluded from the pardon, but they are, for the most part, on board with the oblivion. And this is to be the cornerstone of Charles's policy of forgetting. So in addition to forgetting the past, Charles and Clarendon's other task is to make clear that the Restoration marks a new beginning. And their vision for the future can best be seen in their speeches bringing the convention parliament to a close. Speeches which I know some of my 10th graders are familiar with because they wrote papers on them. So the convention parliament had been the first freely convened parliament, a parliament not summoned by any king or dictator or anyone else. It was seen to be kind of democratic, and this was Charles's first parliament. And this is the parliament that passes the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion. This is the parliament which officially recognizes him as king. And as the session comes to a close, and as Charles is about to send the members of parliament back home to their districts, to their constituents, he wants to make sure that they bought into his message, that they can share Charles's vision with their constituents. So key to the speeches given by Charles and as well as his Chancellor Clarendon was that Charles II was not Charles I. The old adversarial relationship between king and parliament that had characterized the years before the civil wars would not be the case in the Restoration. Charles told the members, quote, "I brought with me an extraordinary affection and esteem for parliaments. I need not tell you how much it is improved by your carriage towards me. My heart is exceedingly enlarged. Let us all resolve that this be forever called the healing and blessed Parliament." So, though Charles didn't mention his father in his speech, it's clear that he's trying to emphasize that he is not going to be Parliament's enemy, but that he's going to be Parliament's friend. Clarendon, the Chancellor, went even further by painting a picture of Charles as a tender-hearted monarch whose only thought was his subjects' happiness. Clarendon told the members, quote, "When he, Charles, hath been informed of any less kind or jealous thing said amongst you, as your windows are never so close shut but that the sound of your words go to the several corners of the town, his majesty hath been heard to say no more, but what have I done? I wish that gentleman and I were better acquainted, that he knew me better." Clarendon insisted that Charles II would be a very different monarch from Charles I, from the monarch that people remembered. Clarendon reminded the members that Charles II had restored law and order, and that the dark days of the past were over. Clarendon insisted that the members of Parliament tell their constituents, quote, "They are now free from those midnight alarms which they have been terrified of, and can rise out of their beds at their own healthy hours, without being saluted with the death of a husband, a son, a friend, miserably killed the night before. This enfranchisement is worth all that they pay." Peace, Clarendon claimed, had been restored, and a new, brighter future lay ahead. So while it's easy for Charles and Clarendon to ask the people forget, to give speeches about forgetting, to issue declarations and statutes, creating the new era of peace that the convention parliament was pitched was no easy task. And they had already experienced firsthand how difficult the task before them was as they wrestled with Parliament over the passing of this Act of Indemnity and Oblivion. The English were asked to forget about the civil wars, to forget about Charles I's rocky relationship with Parliament, but at the same time remember that Charles II was the late king's son, and as Charles I's son, the rightful ruler of England. So what then, in practice, did the new king's selective amnesia look like? So to begin with, as we said, even though the monarchy begins in 1660, Charles, even in the Declaration of Breda, says, this is the 12th year of my reign. I have been king the whole time. I've just not been in England. I've just not been on the throne. So all the government documents like the Act, they're all numbered by regnal years, by the year of the king's reign, and so the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion is